You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'd like to introduce the next episode, episode number 51 in our Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Tirtha Mukhopadhyay. And we're going to spend an hour with him talking about the origin of religion, its cultural development, and the nature of all things relating to cosmology, shamanism, animism, and symbolism with respect to rock art and other things of a religious fervor. Hello, everyone in Archaeology Podcast land. This is your host to the Rock Art Podcast. This is episode 51. We're one shy of a full year of hourly long podcasts. And I'm very, very excited to have as my guest scholar, my friend and colleague, Dr. Tirtha Mukhopadhyay, who teaches at Guanajuato University in the remarkable country of Mexico over the south of the border. He has been on our program once before, and that particular program was the most downloaded of all of the 51 segments that we've had so far. So we're looking forward to another spirited discussion and probably a great volume of people that have tremendous interest in the kinds of discussions we're having. We're going to talk about the origins of religion, the history of religion, the way to talk about and consider that data set from a number of different perspectives. Dr. Mukhopadhyay, Tirtha, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good to talk to you, Alan, once again. And this is one of our favorite themes for exchange of ideas and going ahead with the kind of research that we're doing through this entire region. So I'm very grateful to have come back once again to talk to you.
Tirtha, we're honored, and I know that we'll have a rather engaging and dynamic conversation. Why don't we open it up with the same kind of question we've had before? How did you ever get involved in sort of the study of religion, hearkening back to your roots, and the understanding of perhaps symbolism and the nature of how this all interfingers into cultural evolution?
Yes, very well. This question is very relevant, and it's also a personal question for me, especially in the context of the sciences and anthropology and human culture. Since I was a student of philosophy in school, I became interested in the question of religion and how could we define the religious experience, and also art, because I was studying art. So I started to look at religions from different points of view, really. And the question which became most important for me during even the start of my career was, how did the religions evolve? The evolution of religions, the origin of religions, and why do humans display this behavior, which we call a religious behavior? Why do they have faith? Why do they carry a belief in something transcendent, and how are these experiences of transcendence, experiences of some kind of supernatural contact or magic, what are the expressions of religion in the different time layers? And to look at this broad evolution of religion in the world, these are the questions that really riveted my attention when I started working on the theme at school.
And this is sort of the questions that, you know, have tremendous interest to the general public and the academic community: the relationship between science and religion, the understanding of art and ritual, and also the use of altered states of consciousness and means of establishing some sort of transcendent relationship with a higher power, and how to deal with tremendous angst or health issues, etc., and how even the relationship can come between healers, doctors, and Indian doctors, yes, indigenous doctors, and how they approach this exercise, and all of that that package of phenomenon, is interfingered, is it not?
Yes. The question is, why do we believe in the existence of transcendent states? Why do we believe in the existence of gods and goddesses or ancestral spirits? And the first task that any scholar of religion would have is to identify and really distinguish, to see that this kind of experience is part of the panoply of psychological experiences that the human being already possesses. But if there are very special characteristics in this kind of experience, so the question may begin with human psychology. And the other related question is, from where did this kind of psychology emerge in nature? Because the human being has been evolving for 15 million years from the first offshoots of the hominid, what they call the hominid phase of existence, which is like 15 million years ago.
Right, and proto-humans.
Proto-humans, and very closely allied to other apes, the superior apes. But the human beings gradually differentiated into, you know, the what we call the Homo sapiens. But before the Homo sapiens, I mean, the real human evolution and the consciousness and the evolution of a consciousness, of a human consciousness with very advanced thinking capabilities, may be pinned down to like 3 million years with the evolution of the Homo erectus and bipedalism. So what happens at that stage when the human being becomes a bipedal animal and has special features of mobility, special features, prehensile features, holding objects, of working with material objects, and what kind of changes in intelligence might have occurred during this phase of evolution.
And what might have triggered some sort of personal knowledge of, you know, recognition,
yes,
of the state of being of humankind, and the ability to sort of capture images or ceremonies or rituals that have been found archaeologically, yes, that look like early religion.
Interestingly, in archaeology, we do not have any evidence of cultural objects or objects which have been given a deliberate shape or configuration for a period before 110, 120,000 years. Now, if you look at Marshak's findings and commentaries, mm-hmm, on the first probable Neanderthal evidences of shapes of things like made with human bones, like, mm-hmm, flutes or probable funerary remains or
things like that.
Yeah, things like that. But that's only 120,000 years.
Right.
And we are looking at first, however, at 3 million years before, which is like when the human being is just coming out of a more ape-like condition, an ape-like configuration of our posture, and is beginning to deal with the world in different ways. There is no archaeological evidence for that. We are looking at a paleo history, which is much, much beyond what scope of our current research.
But what has been discovered recently, which is fascinating, is that a different species of human may have actually had the ability to create imagery on stone and paintings.
Oh, yes.
Primitive, yes. Simple, yes. But yeah, rather remarkable nonetheless.
Yes. I think this is an event of great significance when we first begin to see the evidences of anthropomorphization, or the totem, which is in anthropological parlance, you call it the totem, which is like, you know, it's like a wooden, it may be made of wood, it may be made of stones. And totemism is the practice of representing a god or a deity or an ancestral spirit, and placing this object at the heart of a community or collective of people, a tribe, you may call it. And this, the practice of totemism is identifiably not in an anthropology, we can think of what we call the Cro-Magnon era and the creative explosion 60, 70,000 years before the Common Era. And from this time period of 70,000 years, so there was a lull in production of cultural objects from 120,000 years back to 70,000 years. And then there is a sudden creative explosion. So this period is called the creative explosion. And after the creative explosion, we begin to see the emergence of anthropomorphic forms, deities, gods, goddesses.
Yep.
And we begin to see, you know, the Venus.
Right, the Venus figurines.
Yes, the Venus figurines from North Africa.
We actually recently had an interview with a woman who did a thesis on Venus figurines, and that was an interesting expression as well. But
yes.
Yes.
And that really marks the period of the first anthropomorphic representations. I think this is a period we need to look at to understand the evolution of religions, because this is a very concrete phase of visual representations in human culture, where the human being is trying to project some kind of supernatural, numinous, godlike figure, a spirit. It's an object, a visual object, but it's at the same time something supernatural.
Right.
Yes.
And I know you and I have talked about this. I don't think there's an abundant literature that is meaty and engaging and really deals with this rather effectively.
No, you are very right about that. And this is where we have been working. And, you know, there are parallel expressions of this phenomenon. But we have been dealing very closely with the Aztecan, the Proto-Uto-Aztecan, the appearance of this phenomenon in North America, in the American Southwest. And there might have been possible connections.
Absolutely. But if we hearken back to what, 40, 50, 60,000 years ago, and we look at those figurines, and we look at some of the imagery,
yes,
the actual sculptures and other very primitive things, one of the things I'm always struck with that it doesn't seem to have had a lot of press is the gestures, the sort of, how would you put this, the connection of the physiology and the physical effects of individual postures that lead one to the idea,
yes,
of transcendence. How's that?
Yes. The very nature of the representation, the representation of gods and goddesses and the supernatural creatures that we have, that's a layer of existence. And this is so interesting, and this has not been studied so well. We believe, you believe, and I believe that we have been trying to identify for the cultures of North America, Paleo Indian phase of North American, of the migrations into North America from different parts of Siberia, the Beringia may have been humans coming across Polynesia and the Pacific and the other route across Greenland into North America. So North America is a relatively late expression, a late phase of that process of the evolution of anthropomorphic
religions. Kind of late to the party, huh?
Religions. Late to the party, and that's why it's so relevant.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But even if it's late to the party,
yeah,
one is so much struck by the parallels in the iconography and communication and design and posture and forms and character of the symbolism and the other elements, the whole sort of pattern that this goes with. Well, that's about all we have time for in this first segment. Let's get into some of the strategies and methods in the next. See you on the flip-flop, gang. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and this is the 51st episode of the Rock Art Podcast. And we have with us Tirtha Mukhopadhyay, who's a distinguished professor at the Guanajuato University in Mexico. And we're journeying with him to discuss his views and his reflections and ideas about the origin and development of religion. Hey, Tirtha, we're back together again, I think, in this segment. I think we want to try to talk about how you have made some inroads in dealing with this question of the origin and development of religion and what data sets and methods you may have found most productive. How's that?
Yes, I'd like to really continue to talk about the chronology of this evolution and the way in which humans would really come up to express themselves linguistically with the great texts of the religious civilizations, the Old Testament, like Moses and, you know, Vyasa, or even before them, the Vedas. And some of the oldest surviving texts, but to come to that point of religious expression, belief, the humans had to evolve through time and had to really have ideas about what humans have always believed in, which is a spirit world, the afterworld, or some form of existence which takes us beyond the way in which we act and feel and behave in this world where we are born and where we live for a certain period of time and then we die. So the question of mortality, the question of existence, the question of the difficulties in life and the impossibility of achieving whatever humans want to achieve. So these are the most profound questions at the heart of human existence. This is a question about existence itself. And nothing else matters because what happens to us? So what happens is that humans begin to represent these spirit beings, not just through sculptures, through three-dimensional objects made of rock. They may have been sculpting spirit-like entities with the rock medium, but they have also been drawing and representing, and rock art is especially relevant here, and the kind of figures and figurines, male and female, the residue of the human physiological structure, or the body, the head, the hands, these are all retained in the representation of spirits and gods and goddesses. And they are presumably thought to have power that they can affect us. And what seemed to be most interesting about these images is that these images seem to have a psychological impact and a visual impact, a visual cognitive impact. And if I may go on, what I discovered in my research on the kind of psychological impact that visual images have it all really, the inquiry started with the question of how the human beings look at the world outside, look at nature and other entities, other living animals. So the question of predators, the question of it may be a carnivorous animal looking at the human being, or a snake. The human being confronts a snake and looks at the eyes of the snake and responds with the, you know, what we now call the flight or fight response. It's a psychological mechanism of dealing with things which are very powerful and which may harm, which may injure us, which may kill us. And we may be food for the other carnivores. And so it's a great existential crisis in the context of raw nature. And I can't vouch for it, but I think that some of the power inherent in the visual symbolism of spirits, of these gods and goddesses, especially the kind of power that is ingrained in the eyes of gods and goddesses. You know, if you look at the concentric eyes and the pupils, the dilated pupils and the contracted eye, there is an interplay of...
Yeah, the concentric circle and the spiral seems cross-culturally to be part of a sort of a cosmological, world-class, cross-cultural understanding that we're talking about a portal. We're talking about a portal. We're talking about a connection to the supernatural. And we're also talking about a image, a symbol that rivets one's attention. And it's used to this very day in advertising. Target stores have that, you know, and again and again. It's so deeply ingrained in our, in the neuropsychology, in the software of our minds, that it's an intuitive psychological thing to be entrained on that image. Am I correct?
Of course, the Target icon that you referred to, the supermarket Target icon, it's a method of drawing attention. You know, like you draw the attention of a hunter, or an archer as well. It's the same psychological mechanism. Now that you speak about it, I guess absolutely true. Because some of the rock art visuals, these anthropomorphs, have these very similar associations. Their head may be a concentric circle instead of having two eyes. And, you know, the Fibonacci spiral that you referred to, it has a hypnotic effect on the viewer. Mm-hmm. And this has been the standard practice in realms of faith and the supernatural from the Pleistocene for at least 10 to 15,000 years before the common era, before present. And this makes us wonder that there is something to it, because the belief is that there is a kind of effect on us, and that these are very powerful agents. So the element of power, the element of the ability of being able to make an impact, like the carnivores, like the natural threats in the environment, is very important in the development of religions. And if we look at the vestiges of the same process, when you look at the iconography of the tainted glass, the Byzantine iconography of the Virgin Mother and the baby Christ, and you look at the eyes, and you'll find immense power, maybe even an immense dimension of grace or harmony. So a coexistence of emotions on a heightened level of impactfulness. That is what is very interesting about religious depictions and cultural expressions.
And all of this is sort of ensconced in this backdrop of dealing with these specialists, these ritual adepts whose responsibility it is somehow, as priests and native indigenous doctors, to harness or connect with the ancestral spirit figures. You know, they talk about speaking with the dead, the ancestor spirits, or connecting with the supernatural gods and goddesses, yes, to bring down the rain, increase the harvest, guarantee the protection and longevity and sustainability of a culture.
It's like this explains the reliance on animism, the faith in animism, because the image that you see on the surface of the rock, if you look at the Kosa rock art, the extremely powerful rock art, one of the best examples in the context of rock art in the whole world, you see that there's this, this explains animism. This explains the fact that humans not only believed that these are visual representations, they believe that they are no longer lifeless objects, that they have a life. They have a power to impact upon you.
These are sentient beings, rocks, cracks, yes, water, drainages, yes, mountains, mm-hmm, all these things that conventionally from a Western ideology are inanimate to indigenous people, mm-hmm, are alive with power, being, and agency. Can you explain that?
Yes, it's the notion of agency is very important. That it has been called in various ways in contemporary anthropology, the power of the sacred image. That Daniel Dennett calls it the intentional stance, for example, the human intentions. That it's also a kind of counterfactual image. And what this means is that the human being believes that the human beings, the results of his actions are not predictable. And this comes from human experience. And so if they are not predictable, the counterfactual argument, the if possibility, is that there may be some other controlling agency. There may be a superior power or will at work, which is really controlling us and the destiny of our actions, the desired fulfillment, whatever we want, the good things that we want for family, for the offspring. So all these are being controlled by superior powers. So this is like we are setting up a center of intention, of superior controlling intention beyond our own limited abilities to satisfy our intentions, our limited abilities of success.
And I think, as you know, someone might say, well, boy, you know, that sounds rather silly from a Western industrial scientific realm, yes, to even think about things in that way.
Yes.
But hasn't it become more and more centered and more well evidenced by physicists and other scientists that there is something to this higher order cosmological understanding of the perspective of agency and an understanding of sort of an intricate power that interweaves throughout the universe, some sort of a connection or ethereal thread, if I'm getting this correct?
Yes, yes. This is where the question of connectivity, the question of being linked to superior agencies come in. And the point is that this has been there in human civilization from the last 70,000 years after the creative explosion, after the Neanderthals are supposed to have been, you know, really wiped out in the competition for survival, and as the Homo Neanderthalus, the end of the line of Homo Neanderthalus for the emergence of the Homo sapiens as a more efficient creature in the panorama of survival. And the Homo sapiens is wisdom, and that perhaps this wisdom is defined in terms of the link that the homo, that the human has with these superior centers of agency, of intention. And so the human being carries the so-called yes. religious consciousness, the consciousness of a superior intentional
being and being. Essence.
Yes.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Yes. And it's most evident in anthropomorphic representations. So if we are to look at the origins of religions, we will have to look at anthropomorphic representations. Because from the evidence of anthropology, there are two things here we need to contend with, at least for the last 15,000 years in the what we call the Pleistocene, or the like 10 to 15,000 years before the present, when the glaciers started melting and temperatures were rising all over the world and a new kind of vegetation was getting to be visible, and humans were moving out towards more temperate zones, following their transitions, their migrations across more colder ice-laid regions. Yes, and so what was happening at this point was in the Pleistocene is what anthropologists have discovered. They're called the megaliths. The megalithic. I think there's a megalithic phase.
Well, let's stop there for a moment. Let's take a deep breather here, and we'll stop with the megalithic, the big rock rock sculptures and rock tombs and rock alignments, and we'll jump to the next segment, where I think we're going to go into some of the data sets and maybe even do a case study or two regarding how we can come to some intricate knowledge of indigenous religion and the cultural evolution of religion and its symbolism. See you on the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang, to Archaeology Podcast Land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for the 51st episode of the Rock Art Podcast. And we are just blessed and honored to have a world-class scholar, Tirtha Mukhopadhyay, doctor, professor from the University of Guanajuato in Mexico. And we've been having a ball just tracing and reviewing the nature of some of the scientific thoughts and the way we can understand the origins and development of religion, how that relates to science and other related subject matters, including rock art, of course, but also the understanding of the physiological basis for some of these and the psychological basis and how that relates to art and symbolism. So I think in this last segment, Tirtha, maybe you could bear down on some of the data sets and some of the methods that you have used in your dissertation and in your other scholarly research in tracing the development of religion.
You know, this is a vast topic, and we would need to dedicate a lot of time to look at all those layers. But I'm really interested in primarily in three layers from the Pleistocene, that is the last 15,000 years after the glacial meltdowns. And here what happens is we have a megalithic phase, and megaliths are there all over Europe, all over Asia. They're there in the Americas and in Australia. Megaliths are a very ancient form of religion. And I think megalithic religion is the religion that separates the religion of a more ancient Homo sapien form of consciousness from the more recent anthropomorphic method of religion. So I wish to draw a line there, you know. And this is an evolution in human consciousness, in representations, which I think is most significant as far as the religions are concerned, and which I don't think have been noted so well. Why? Because you need to look at the content of megalithic religions, and you need to look at the content of ancestral religions that is, religions of spirit, the religions of anthropomorphic forms, deities, gods, goddesses. This is a deviation. Here is a very significant deviation, because megalithic civilization, megalithic consciousness is rooted to earth. It is rooted to earth, and it is rooted to magnetism. It is rooted to astronomy in a way in which has been developed. It represents both a development and a deviation from the megalithic layer of consciousness.
So I think what's going on here is that megalithic level, that megalithic sort of stratum of representation, is a good one to really showcase the relationship of archaeological features, representations of citadels or ceremonial and ritual structures that relate back to the earth, but also relate back to the sky.
Yes.
So you've got the earth and the sky, you've got the archaeoastronomy, but you also have the nested or the integral relationship that those features, that those ceremonial structures have, in terms of impressing, and endowing the earth with something special.
Yes, very much so. And look, if you look at those structures, well, the megaliths are usually oriented in the form of a circle, or they may be a long line of rocks, and or they may be a particular kind of geometrical configuration, and they are usually aligned to the movement of the sun in the horizon, and horizon, which is horizon astronomy. But the religion of ancestral spirits has its origins in megalithic cultural structures, like the circle, for example, archaeoastronomy. The notion that these spirits are in some way related to certain aspects of the heavens, the universe, of the sky, and that these are not just arbitrarily placed in as a matter of consciousness, because the spirit would mean nothing if the spirit is not aligned to some kind of cosmic plane that takes you to the beyond the earth to the heavens.
And so as we begin to develop these religious specialists, these religious adepts, mm-hmm. these individuals that help us to deal with and bring down the ancestors or revere the ancestral spirits and those that have passed on and those that are super mundane beings in the heavens, we begin to see this transportation corridor. We've got the Milky Way as sort of the
mm-hmm. absolutely
the super highway to the heavens, and then we have certain constellations that are part of the storyline and the sacred narrative, aren't they?
Yes, the notion of the auspicious moment, which is so intrinsic to religions like Hinduism, like Buddhism, to Islam, to Christianity. You know, you are citing the stars, the constellations, the planets, and there are moments which are especially favorable for prayers, for fasting, for, you know, all these aspects, and the spirits, all those messengers of God, that they are residing in some plane allied to or in alignment with those cosmic planes, those cosmic orientations. So the spirit world is really is very interesting, and it has to be understood. Yeah.
So if we look at the ethnographic record, both historically and even the indigenous people as well, with that were pre-literate, there seems to be a continuing thread about this prayers or connection or some sort of way to tether those who have passed on and passed away, mm-hmm. the dead, and to see them as a means of sort of being the liaisons or the intermediaries for the supramundane beings or those of the gods and goddesses that can be helping spirits. Now, the reason I say that in part is even for the Catholic tradition, Catholicism 2,000 years ago, we have these pictures of these individuals that are praying to the ancestors to intercede for them and ask the creator gods to help them in their lives.
Yes, of course.
Which is fascinating.
It is. And if you look at the way the belief of the indigenous of the religions here in North America and their notion of a family line, their notion of deriving from, you know, cosmic sphere.
And there's a kinship. Yeah. There's a tradition. There's a genealogy. And so if we talk about totemism, what we're mm-hmm. talking about, even to this very day, is Native people who have a belief that there are certainly supernatural or unusual animal-human figures that they have a kinship with, and they were descended from, and they pray to, and they sing about, and they connect with.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, Alan, and since we don't have all the time, maybe what I would like to talk about in the next few minutes would be, if you allow me, it would be the evolution of monotheism.
Sure. Please.
And the notion of a one God. So from megaliths to ancestral religions and polytheism, we could now move on to defining this phenomenon of monotheistic religions. And this is very interesting because there is this very tremendous enthusiasm, zeal for monotheistic beliefs. But I think the problem of polytheism or monotheism, the question whether for believers, whether there's one God or there are other gods, this question may be set down to more of religious polemic. And there are no religions in the world that are not polytheistic. The Catholic faith is polytheistic. The Islam is polytheistic in the sense it has its ancestral bearings, its belief in the messengers of God, although it very zealously talks about this one God. I think this consciousness of a monotheistic God is a kind of focusing. It's a pattern of thinking in human societies, which is not very, very old, but it is focusing on the notion of a single God. And this is again a parallel phenomenon. All faiths, all religious denominations, all kinds of groups of people, anthropologically defined groups, entities, tribes, sub-tribes, you know, they have their own gods.
Chiefdoms, kingdoms, monotheism, civilizations, whatever.
Yes. And they are being guided by their god, which is to say that among the other gods, they have their god. So they may not be disrespecting other gods. They may be having a very strong preference for their own god. And if we look at monotheism in this way, it brings us to this question of a god, of a father god, or at times a mother god. And in the very advanced, developed, rationally parsed or viewed the extended religions like the Catholic faith, which is the most, I think the Catholic imagination has something to say about monotheism, transcendence, and faith in one God entity, which is far more advanced than anything else than any other religious systems would have. I mean, I'm not valorizing religions, but I'm just looking at the discourse of religions. I'll explain in a moment, very briefly, why I say this, because contemporary religions, like the great religions, they speak of the huge religions like Hinduism, like Shinto, like Chinese, the religion or philosophy of Confucius, for example. If you look at the African religions, they all believe in this enormous sphere or a line of gods.
Yeah, it's a panoply. It's a whole mixture.
Exactly. And it's hierarchical, and it's like amazing in the way that they define where the god is and where the god may not be, and what kind of powers the gods have, the spirits have. And so in this plenum, there is also the monotheistic religions, who speak of gods and goddesses, or their own god. But I think the question here, if a student of religion is going to be the point of reference here, because religion says what the Catholic faith or the Orthodox I would rather call it Orthodox Christianity, Orthodox, sure, the right kind of doxa, suggests that this God is transcendental. This God is heard or felt in the form of a will. So it's a psychological perception of the will, the will of God. The will of God, again, it's like this intentional dance of Daniel Dennett. But this notion of the will of God, the will which is beyond human comprehension, this again connects us to a very matured expression, a very matured analysis of what this will of God is, and we have the literature of the church, of the fathers of the church.
We have a 2,000-year-old record.
Yes,
so it's kind of nice. Yeah. We have about a minute at most, and what do you think the takeaway is from our hour-long discussion, Professor? If there was one thing that you want our listeners to walk away with from our wide-ranging reflections.
Well, I think it is the evolution of the consciousness of God in the consciousness of a center of intention that is beyond the human existence, that is beyond the frames, the limiting and limited frames of references that we have. And this should open up a method of scientific inquiry into the nature of religions.
Absolutely. And I think it shows us throughout history and prehistory and throughout all of our studies, people are the same, and they all have their passions and needs and reach out for something grander than themselves, looking for a connection to the supernatural, to a higher power, and searching for a way to overcome their fears and deal with the challenges of life. Don't you agree?
I couldn't have said it better.
Well, God bless you all that in Archaeology Podcast, Rock Art Podcast land. See you next week on the Flip Flop. And thank you so much, Tirtha, for gracing our Rock Art Podcast. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.